say get off the airplane.
But this is your captain speaking, okay. But never like this.
I'll stop, and we'll fly the airplane. Don't worry, I'm going to let my co-pilot fly it. He's a man. Okay?
It's a total meltdown. The pilot boarded in her street clothes and addressed the passengers over the intercom. Passenger Pam O'Neill couldn't believe what was happening.
She said, let's take a vote. How many of you would like to take
I'm wondering if we'll get a copyright for this.
As I am, or would you prefer that I take 10 minutes?
I can pause it real quick.
So, yeah, let's just cut it off. Because so this lunatic woman pilot gets on without her uniform on and then gets on the PA system and just goes off on everybody. And she's like,
Wait, hold on. He's right. The document did condemn cyberbullying. We can't do that anymore.
That's our whole show.
We're done. We're done, guys.
That's all we do is cyberbully.
Bro, this document was literally just for you guys.
I miss Christian Mario. He's been off Twitter for Schismatic Lent.
Makes sense. Got to get in touch with that fellow Zoomer.
All right. So Rob and I have been talking about it. I think what we're going to do is we're going to cut the show off of his and I's personal Twitter accounts. And we're going to just start streaming to YouTube and the Avoiding Babylon Twitter account. So if you guys are not subscribed to the actual Avoiding Babylon Twitter account, please go do that. And I think we're just going to stream, you know, to that one and keep it off our own personal Twitter accounts. I don't know. We kind of just want to condense everything down. And
people, you know, who have watched on the different Twitters, they've said that they wish that they were all together in one stream.
Which they are if you go to the Avoiding Babylon thing. So also we are on Locals, and we typically do an hour on here and then an hour on Locals on most shows. Tonight, I don't know if we're going to do that, but I have to start off by saying the traditional Thomist was 100% correct in his predictions.
Yep.
Like on the money. He said it's going to be pretty good on some of the social issues, the gender change stuff and things like that. And it's going to be mainly immigration and the death penalty stuff. And that's pretty much what we got, right?
Well, yeah. The death penalty, there was really only one small section that talked about it, but
it's pretty short overall.
Okay, Nicholas, what was your biggest criticism?
My biggest criticism of the document was particularly a phrase that was used in the section on the death penalty, which was, it talks about the death penalty, you know, it violates human dignity in all circumstances. Now, there's a right way that I could read it in the sense of thinking like, okay, you know, man does have human dignity, and because the death penalty is ending the life, therefore it equals, you know, you're technically doing violence against that person's dignity. The problem, though, is that when you take that with the backdrop of everything else that we've heard from the pontificate about the death penalty, it's just like, all right, well, this just sounds like more kind of preaching on anti-death penalty stuff. So that was one of my main issues. But then I felt like even all of the good stuff in the document, there was a lot of good, right? I was thrilled that he actually is talking about like being against sex changes and against the gender ideology. That was all really good.
Went hard against surrogacy.
Yeah, exactly. That was all really, really good. Some of the way I didn't like it, though, is that because it was all framed through the lens of human dignity, it still gives a problematic understanding of sin. So they should have, in my opinion, this is just Nick's opinion, done this through the lens of these violate God's eternal laws. These are sins. These put your soul in danger. They were looking at this much from like a naturalistic, I felt like, perspective, not totally, but things like that. And then, yeah, deportation, being against deportation. I'm like, yo, we got like 4 million a year in our country. We need help here. So,
well, I don't understand like that, especially like how can it be against the dignity of the person if they illegally came across the border to just put them back to where they came from? I think the most problematic paragraph is paragraph 12, though, where they actually almost sound like they are pushing a works-based salvation.
Where like the middle of that, where they're kind of, it's almost like liberation theology.
No, it talks about how in the final judgment, there will be one thing how you loved your neighbor that you'll be judged upon.
Yeah.
And
so it says,
and your race, religion, creed, bloodline, none of that matters. So like your religion doesn't matter at all. Just how you loved your neighbor is the sole criterion upon which we will be judged.
Yeah. For Jesus, the good done to every human being, regardless of the ties of blood or religion, is the single criterion of judgment.
Like that's insane.
Yeah. That's
right. That is insane. That is a works-based salvation. It has nothing to do with, I mean, that's just so not Catholic at all in any manner whatsoever. Like, what? I don't know, man. I don't see how you could, I don't see how, because I've been thinking about how to play this show. Like, I've been thinking about playing Francis Advocate, you know, instead of Devil's Advocate.
Like, I was going to play. Did you try so hard?
But I don't know if I can, because there's a bunch of stuff in it that I had a hard time with.
So paragraph 11, kind of on your point there, Anthony, says to be created in the image of God means to possess a sacred value that transcends every distinction of a sexual, social, political, cultural, and religious nature. So it's saying that dignity transcends religion somehow.
So, all right, now, can you read that in, I mean, it's strange because they are almost using the word dignity as if you could just switch it around with created in the image and likeness of God. Like that to them, created in the image and likeness of God is all, like almost like divine adoption doesn't even mean anything. You know, being baptized doesn't raise a man's dignity in any way whatsoever. It's a difficult document to swallow. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's a right way you can read it, because it's like if you're reading human dignity as just like, hey, you're a human created in the image and likeness of God, and regardless of where you come from or what you believe in, like there's certain just natural like laws and rights and decorum that you deserve. Like that you can be read good. But then to your point, if it's included in the topic of at the end of time, you're only going to be judged on how you treated people based off of like if you had love for them, that's very concerning, because that basically, in my opinion, puts the spiritual works of mercy juxtaposed and against the corporal works of mercy. So it's just like, yeah, focus on feeding the poor and helping the needy, but don't instruct them in doctrine. That gets in the way.
Yeah, it's they're pitting love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind against love your neighbor as yourself. They're pitting those two things against each other. It's a strange thing. It's like, well, love the Lord your God with all your heart will lead to love of neighbor, but they almost like sideline that for just love of neighbor. That's what it seems like. I don't know.
It's a bit rough. It is a bit rough. One thing I did like, I will say that I did like about the document, was the fact that when it got to the discussion on gender ideology, I really did like the fact that they did get into some of the specifics when it came to like the understanding of gender versus sex. To a degree, they kind of touched upon that, which I thought was helpful, because one of the things I was afraid of is that they would go into the discussion and basically not even understand the transgender arguments and actually address them flat out. I'm glad they did that. And I'm glad that you did see, I don't know if you guys saw this, but the White House responded to this whole fiasco, if you will.
Really? I didn't see that.
So the White House press secretary, she came out and she said that she was speaking on behalf of Joe Biden, who she said that the things that they like were the fact that it doesn't target, you know, and again, I don't even know, I didn't see this in the document, but that, you know, essentially, you shouldn't have anti-homosexuality laws, which I've heard that there is a quote from Fernandez in like a press briefing or something post the release of this document where he says that like he regrets that there are countries that have anti-homosexuality laws. And I'm wondering if this is a reference, like a pointed reference to the African bishops who were very much so against fiducia. But then, of course, the Biden administration came out and said that they're always going to stand up and be advocates, of course, for transgender rights, homosexual rights, yada, yada, yada. And so it is somewhat interesting that this takes place, you know, if you will, a week-ish after the whole fiasco with the White House on Transvisibility Day happening the fall on Easter.
Mm-hmm. What's amazing to me is that this document took 5 years to write. It doesn't seem like it... it is that deep theologically. It just kind of seems like some of the things they point out about even like the gender stuff, it just seems pretty common sense as a Catholic. Like, yeah, obviously we think this, but I think people are shocked because when FS comes out, the headlines were basically screaming the Catholic Church is changing its teaching. And so seeing the headlines today is almost a little bit refreshing because it's like, oh wait, the Catholic Church actually is upholding Catholic teaching. So it's in that respect, like the scandal is not there like in Fiducia, right? So the things that we're discussing are we're nitpicking within the Catholic commentary. Like there's not, it's not so much.
This isn't really a departure from the previous couple of pontificates. You know, it's not like Fiducia, which was like 180 like, even from three or 4 years ago. This is pretty much in line with JP2 and Benedict with a little bit of liberation theology like sprinkled in
a mix.
So this morning we were in a group text and Rob just starts like fired. He's like, this thing is Freemasonic. He's like going nuts. And I'm like,
we can get into that if you want. Cause it is.
Well, that's what I think we should get into because I think people do want to, you know, hear the breakdown of it. I only got to read through it once, but Rob, you seem like you actually got to really look at this thing.
I did.
You had some notes written and stuff. So let's go through where your first notes are and let's see what you got.
So first off, you want to know why it took them 5 years to write it?
Why?
Because they wanted to release it on the 75th anniversary of the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Is that really why?
That's a good point.
That's when they released it. So,
wow.
But
that's a good point.
It's strange because they all right. So Rob, you sent something to the WhatsApp. I think Rod put it up or something. Just talking about like the different references. Like there's only 10. Pre-council references and two of those. All right, so a quick count of the citations. So there's a total of 116 citations. Pre-Vatican II sources are only 10, two of which are UN Declaration of Human Rights.
Which, for anyone who was unfamiliar with the history of that document from 1948 was largely based upon the French Revolution's Declaration on the Rights of Man.
Exactly, 100%.
56 references to previous France's document like that. There's never in the history of the church been a Pope who self-referenced himself like Francis does. Oh, it's never happened.
And of the 8 non-UN pre-Vatican II sources, one of those is Cicero. So that means only 116 citations, only 7 are from Catholic pre-Vatican II sources.
And some of those might be scripture.
Yeah.
Yeah, some maybe. Of those might be scripture.
there was a lot of scripture, so I'm guessing that isn't in the count, but
probably a few saying quotes here and there, but I did go through the footnotes myself, skim through them, and I didn't see one papal like encyclical bull magisterial text at all from this a pre-conciliar
this,
time.
This guy, I've been seeing this guy pop up on everybody. He was in the Mass of the Ages comments today. Who is this guy?
Sede Hunter. This reminds me.
It's Jeremiah Bannister. 100%.
No, I mean, it's a troll. There's no way they're serious.
I don't know, Sede. Dude.
Yeah, the only church father reference was Irenaeus.
Yeah, that's right. Only one.
All right, so let's go through it. Let's pick the early paragraphs where you thought there was the most problem, the most problematic stuff, Rob, because
so
it sounded very spicy. French Revolution type stuff going on in there. So
I mean, first off, they lay out different definitions of dignity, like different types. The way they define it, the dignity they use throughout the whole document is ontological dignity, which is really different from the way the church has used dignity in the past. The church has always used it in a moral sense. But if you use it in that sense, in this case, then everything they say is completely false.
Yeah.
But anyways, it's like some of the problems start in paragraph like 4, where and they're quoting JP2 here. JP2 says a gospel value that cannot be despised without greatly, this dignity is infringed on the individual level when due regard is not had for values such as freedom and the right to profess one's religion. So you start off right away.
So you're getting into the freedom of religion stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. I think that's all. I think even Benedict spoke about how after, you know, when they saw the American experiment, like they saw it differently than the French Revolution. They're like, oh, maybe we can embrace some of this stuff in the council, because the idea of freedom of religion, you never saw the church ever speak like that before the council, but that sounds kind of just like a reiteration of, what is it? Dignitatis Humanae or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In paragraph 6, it says, dignity is an original datum, something given that is to be acknowledged faithfully and welcomed with gratitude. But, you know, the church's traditional teaching is that it's given by baptism.
Yeah.
Not given to everyone at birth or at conception, but it's given upon baptism. And then in that same paragraph, it mentions fraternity 3 separate times. I've highlighted every time it mentions fraternity. It's got to be about 4 dozen times in this document.
Wow. The whole idea of just the human fraternity thing. But to me, the biggest problem I see with the way modern church speak goes is that they almost don't distinguish between a person who is regenerated, you know, has baptismal regeneration. Like there's, like they don't see divine adoption as being important at all, mm-hmm. and it really. You know, like they have this idea that we're all children of God. Like not everyone is a child of God. You receive divine adoption at baptism, and they're equating, you know, the being created in the image and likeness of God with children of God. And I think there has to be a distinction between those things.
Yeah, they're probably getting a lot of it from the background of Henri de Lubac's book, Supernatural. So Rob might be familiar with this because he's a closet nerd as I am. Apparently, but when you look at Supernatural by de Lubac, this is one of those really big monstrous theology books, if you will, that got a lot of controversy pre-council that really did affect the post-council discussion. And basically, without getting really abstract with you guys, basically before the council, if you go back and just read traditional Catholic thought, right, you have those who are unregenerate, right, those who are not baptized, and then those who are baptized. But regardless, when you're born, right, all of us have original sin on our conscience, and even though we're made for God, you know, we're bent in toward ourselves. We're selfish people. We're misusing the good, if you will. Whereas Henri de Lubac in his book Supernatural said, well, you know, all man, even though they have original sin, all of us still are in a sense pointed toward God from birth. All of our faculties are somewhat pointed forth toward God. And what this led to was essentially kind of a quasi, dare we hope, impractical evangelistic mentality, where it was like, okay, you know, we have the privileged route, but yet every authentic, and I'm quoting John Paul II now, every authentic prayer from everybody on earth is inspired by the Holy Spirit. End quote, right? Which that, of course, is not true, right? There's false prayer, yeah. There's true prayer, etc. And so I think that the problem is that this is very naturalistic. It puts aside the need for the sacraments, the need for regenerating grace. Notice also, and this is one of my big criticisms of the document, they go through and they condemn a lot of these ideologies, but then they don't subsequently attach anathemas to those who do support gender ideology, who are clearly in the church.
Yeah.
So they should be like saying, hey, look, here's the bad stuff with gender ideology according to the church teaching. Anathema. Boom.
Yeah, that's what it looks. So everybody's like, oh, no, this was so good. This was so good. I thought it was pretty weak. You know, I mean, it was obviously, you know, they're obviously correct when they're speaking about that stuff, but it just came off as very, for such a pressing issue that is weighing on our culture with the amount of children being harmed by this. I was hoping for a little more. Like you were saying in your predictions, you're like, I think they're going to come out pretty strong about this stuff. It was pretty wishy-washy, in my opinion. It came off as just doing everything they could to say it as charitably, which not even really charitably, it's really just non-offensively to you know, as they possibly could, just to avoid bad headlines, you know.
Yeah, 100%. And it's interesting too, because if you think about it, the way I look at this document is, while so much of it is right, even though we do have our issues with it, the tone in which it's written in, it sounds very much so like, you know, a social worker who's a Catholic writing a document like this. This is what it sounds like.
All right. So I have a few paragraphs written down that I wanted to actually discuss. But if you, Rob, if you want to go through some of the other things, you had some of your notes.
I'll pick up the bigger ones. Nick, you said it. A lot of it is very naturalistic sounding. Paragraph 8 has one of those. It says, it basically says, in cases of extreme poverty, individuals do not even have what is minimally necessary to live according to their ontological dignity, which kind of is contradictory. So you're saying they have this built-in dignity for being human, but extreme poverty somehow gets rid of that dignity, which you say is impossible. So that part seemed weird, because, like, since when do we need anything to live in a dignified manner? Like, when do I need creature comforts too big to be dignified? It seems very materialistic.
Yeah. Okay. Can you read that? Can you read that again?
Yeah. So it says, I'll kind of just start off at the beginning of that paragraph. There are still two other possible aspects of dignity to consider: social and existential. When we speak of social dignity, we refer to the quality of a person's living conditions. For example, in cases of extreme poverty, where individuals do not even have what is minimally necessary to live according to their ontological dignity, it is said that these poor people are living in an undignified manner.
That kind of gets into what, when we talked about Schneider's book, right? Where Schneider was making a distinction when he was talking about people that have, like, the unbaptized not having, like we were saying, like, there are things you could do that are undignified, you know, like if a woman goes and dresses, you know, immodestly, like that, like she is not, you know, she's being undignified because she's worth more than that, and she's downplaying her own dignity. So it's a weird thing that they're doing there, because in one sense they're saying everybody has infinite dignity, and people are making a big deal out of that phrase, infinite dignity. I do think that there's a way to, I don't know, man, this is just, it just stinks that, like, nothing clear and, like, bold can come out of, like, we're doing everything we can to just be charitable on this, but it just stinks that nothing clear and concise can just come out and just, look, this is what's going on, this needs to be done, this is what's wrong in the world, we need to fix this. It's pretty frustrating.
Yeah, it is kind of wishy washy. I think, to your point, Rob, on that particular piece, maybe the way you could read it is, it's like kind of like Anthony's example of, like, if you are impoverished, right, it does affect you in your just living capacity, and so maybe, you know, it is something that, if you will, like, you look down upon people in poverty and you just say, maybe, like, you know, they have nothing, maybe they don't have any clothes, maybe they're in the mud, etc. You're like, it's very undignified the way that they are. The issue, though, I agree with you, is that, like, if you're going to talk about this ontologically, poverty doesn't really have any factor, because ontologically, like, you are a human, therefore you just have dignity, period. Mm-hmm. You know, regardless of the situation, you could be misusing it, but doesn't seem to be the way that they're saying
it. Depending on how you live in poverty, it could actually increase your moral dignity.
I mean, oh, for sure. Yeah. Like, if you're religious, religious, etc.
Yeah. Poverty is only, it only stinks if you don't want to be poor, right? Like, if you embrace poverty, it's very different. That could actually make you holy. They give four different types of dignity, and you guys keep conflating them. Surely, who's not being charitable? We're trying to figure it out.
Conflating them because the document conflates them. It lays out four, and then it just uses the word dignity over and over and over again in all these different circumstances. So who is actually conflating them? I would argue it's the document.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to figure out, right? Because there's a certain amount of dignity that every person has because they're created in the image and likeness of God. But there has to be a difference in that, and then when you're baptized and actually a child of God. Like, I don't like that we don't distinguish that anymore. And I don't like so many people think everyone's a child of God. And I'm trying to figure out if that's the distinction they're trying to make in these four different types of dignity, but it doesn't sound like they even distinguish whatsoever about the Christian and anybody else in the world, any non-Christian, like it's like everybody just has equal dignity.
Because if they did believe that would be against Vatican I. It would be against one of the solemn anathemas of Vatican I.
Which one?
It would be Canon 6 of Dei Filius. It says, if anyone says that the condition of the faithful and those who have not yet attained to the only true faith is alike, more or less, then let him be anathema.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So he's saying, fair enough. Fair enough, but I think it's pretty obvious in the context. Which type of we're, obviously, like if you're in extreme poverty, you're living in an undignified manner, and we have a responsibility, especially those with more have a responsibility to help those that are less fortunate. It just seems like they are, everything is about natural ends and coming up with some way to end poverty. You know, it's just, mm-hmm. I don't know. So, all right, what do you got next? Because paragraph 12 was my first one. That was where, let's read that. Let's actually read that.
Yeah. Born and raised in humble conditions, Jesus reveals the dignity of the needy and those who labor. Then, throughout his public ministry, he affirms the value and dignity of all who bear the image of God, regardless of their social status and external circumstances. Now, this next sentence
that I would agree with, right? Like, Christ did not come for the wealthy. He comes for, it doesn't matter your social status, not anything like that. That's fine.
Jesus broke down cultural and cultic religious barriers.
Okay, so he does, in the sense that he goes to the Samaritans and he goes to the Gentiles, right? So like he does do that.
Restoring mm-hmm. dignity to those who were rejected or considered to be on the margins of society, such as tax collectors, women, children, lepers, the sick, strangers, and widows. He heals, feeds, defends, liberates, and saves.
He does. I mean, that's absolutely true. But we would say, yeah, we're not withholding salvation from anyone outside the Christian faith. It's not like we're keeping the Catholic faith for ourselves. It is the universal church. But God offers salvation to all mankind. So there's a difference in what Jesus is doing. He does go and save them. That doesn't mean he tells them to stay where they are. And I don't know if they're conflating that in the document, but.
Well, since it never talks about actually bringing anyone to the church.
Yeah.
But then it goes on to say, he's described as a shepherd who was concerned about the one sheep that was lost. He identifies with the least of his brethren. In biblical language, the little ones are not only the children, but also the vulnerable, most insignificant, the outcast, the oppressed, the discarded, the poor, the marginalized, the unlearned, the sick, and those who are downtrodden by the powerful. The glorious Christ will judge by the love of neighbor that consists in ministering to the hungry, the thirsty, the stranger, the naked, the sick, the imprisoned, with whom he identifies. For Jesus, the good done to every human being, regardless of the ties of blood or religion, is the single criterion of judgment.
Is that the end of time? Is that the end of time, like our final judgment? I don't know if that's saying that. It's saying for Jesus. Read that again, man. I want to see if I'm misreading that.
For Jesus, the good done to every human being, regardless of the ties of blood or religion, is the single criterion of judgment. So it does seem to say that if you are not Catholic or are not Christian, but yet do good to others, you will be, that is all that Jesus will consider upon judgment day.
Yeah, that's rough. It's not very clear. That's just a lot.
I don't know if that's what it's saying.
Because if it was clear, you could call him on it. No,
okay, but go back a little bit. Go back a sentence or two, and let's see. I'm sorry, I don't mean to keep harping on this, but this is very important.
The glorious Christ. That sounds like Christ on Judgment Day when he comes in glory and power. But the glorious Christ will judge by the love of neighbor that consists in ministering to the hungry, the thirsty, the stranger, the naked, the sick, and the imprisoned, with whom he identifies.
Oh, man, that's very problematic. That is extremely problematic. That's heresy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just problematic. That is like straight up heresy, if that's what it's saying.
It denies the necessity of baptism.
But it also makes it a works-based salvation. I mean, it goes against yeah. Trent. It goes against everything. It's like it goes against everything we. It's
damn it. The Prots got us.
The
guys.
Protestants are right if that's true. Like that's actually the Protestants are right if that's true, and I don't like that. these documents. Wait, we have to address Nick's text today because it was it sent everybody into a tizzy. Tizzy. Who says tizzy?
You do. Broad say tizzy.
Prediction for the new DDF document. Okay, Pope Splainer's most amazing document ever. Michael Lofton, this should be added to the New Testament. Groyper Insel Catholic men, this is based. E-trads who don't read the document, this is the worst. Traditionalists who read the document, there's some good, some bad, but it's really founded on Enlightenment principles. Eastern Catholics, we don't read any theology. Average New Rite attendee, wait, what document? I'm actually, that's, we have to... in the list of questions, I have to ask, what did you think of the most recent document from? That's a good question to ask. All right. So paragraph 12 was the first one I had a big problem with. And then I kind of glanced over it. So the next one I have was like death penalty stuff, paragraph 34. I don't know if you saw stuff in between.
I have quite a bit between that.
Yeah.
I'll go kind of quickly. So 13, the next paragraph. It discusses what it calls developments in Christian thought, and it really celebrates the Renaissance humanism and then Descartes and Kant. Like that's what they consider development in human thought.
Let's hear.
As Christian thought developed, it also prompted and accompanied the progress of humanity's reflection on the concept of dignity. Drawing from the rich tradition of the Church Fathers, which it doesn't mention, classical Christian anthropology emphasized the doctrine of the human being as created in the image and likeness of God and the unique role of the human person in creation. By critically sifting through the inheritance it had received from ancient philosophy, medieval Christian thought arrived at a synthesis of the notion of the person that recognized the metaphysical foundation of human dignity. St. Thomas Aquinas attested to this when he affirmed that person signifies what is most perfect in all nature, that is, a subsistent individual of a rational nature. The Christian humanism of the Renaissance later emphasized this ontological dignity and its preeminent manifestation in free human action. Even in the writings of such modern thinkers as Descartes and Kant, who challenged some of the foundations of traditional Christian anthropology, one can still strongly perceive echoes of revelation. Building upon some recent philosophical reflections about the status of theoretical and practical subjectivity, Christian reflection then came to emphasize even more the depths of the concept of dignity. The 20th century. Because
the Renaissance humanism, you're talking, that's like St. Thomas More.
No, they're talking like Erasmus.
This is like Erasmus, yeah.
Erasmus?
Yeah, Erasmus of Rotterdam. This would like arguably one of the world's smartest individuals of all time. He was the one though that really, one could say he was like a precursor of the Reformation in the sense that he wrote the first like critical edition of a Greek New Testament that Luther picked up and kind of used for his own translations. But what was so radical about this was he picked up basically a Greek New Testament and put it right next to the Latin and was trying to basically illustrate to a degree, oh, look at all that the Catholic Church has been kind of hiding and obscuring in texts, and all these doctrines have kind of come out of nowhere, etc. Yeah, it's a bit cool. I can read all of that, I would say, Rob, in an Orthodox lighting, but yeah, any mention of Descartes and Kant just makes me very nervous.
Well, it seems weird that they point out those three things, but you know, they'll mention medieval development, but they won't mention any of that. Then they get to the Renaissance and then the Enlightenment, and then they talk about Descartes and Kant.
Yeah, it's like I think they're probably throwing it out there like as an illustration of like, look, even these guys kind of agree with us. But the issue is you have to put a ton of airbags around it and be like, even such, you know, if you will, erroneous thinkers as Kant and Descartes, you know, could get it right, you know, or something like that.
I think part of what they're doing, like, because it's strange. It used to be where the Pope would write an encyclical meant for the Catholic faithful.
Yeah.
Right. That's what an encyclical is supposed to be. It's supposed to be an encyclical written to the Catholic faithful, where it seems like everything.
Not even always the laity. It's a lot of times encyclicals were letters meant to be circulated among the bishops.
Yeah.
Yeah. To the brothers.
But this seems like everything they write now is meant to go out to the wider world. And it's like, he's just trying to be a voice among many out there. It's not actually written to the Christian faithful, to the body of Christ, like things that we need to know and stuff like that. So maybe they're trying to appeal to, you know, those who have that enlightenment foundation.
Could be, yeah. I thought it was weird because it's like there's that famous quote you guys probably know from Benedict where he talks about how like Dignitatis Humanae and Gaudium et Spes specifically were supposed to be kind of like a counter syllabus that would unite, if you will, the classical liberal teachings of things like freedom of speech and freedom of religion back to their quote, you know, divine source, even though that's erroneous, like they don't find their divine source, etc. So I'm wondering if maybe some of this comes out of just that kind of broader thinking tradition of, hey, you know, we don't agree with everything of Kant and Descartes, but, you know, let's start calling all the good that we can find in them as a, you know, maybe at best a means of evangelization. The issue is, though, is like every single neo-scholastic before the council would have just been like, don't even cite them, like, unless you're going to put a ton of airbags around it, you know, because the thing is that modern philosophy is at the root of modernism. So I'm not saying that this is modernistic, but the problem is like, if you start tiptoeing in that world without the proper safety parameters, you're going to at least give the faithful who read this, who don't know all the neo-scholastic stuff, the thought of like, oh, well, Kant, Descartes, like they're just modern thinkers. Who cares?
You know, I don't even think the average person even knows who they are anymore.
No,
I agree. I agree.
Like you're citing people, and most people are like who?
Who's Kant? No, exactly. Exactly.
It's all right. So, like I said, the first paragraph I have is 34 death penalty stuff. I figured we could jump on that, but Rob, you keep taking us through your notes.
22, a commitment to one's own freedom, actually seems to be it's a pretty good paragraph, but what I find interesting is that a lot of what it says in there actually seems to contradict a lot of what it said before. So it says like the choice, it says each individual possesses inalienable and intrinsic dignity, but it says the choice to express that dignity and manifest it to the full or to obscure it depends on each person's free and responsible decision. And it mentions St. Irenaeus and St. John Damascene, distinguishing between the image and likeness of God. So it says this understands that the image of God is entrusted to human freedom, so that under the guidance and spirit of the action, the person's likeness to God may grow, and each person may attain their highest dignity. So
they're distinguishing between dignity again. All right. Well, that's kind of what
they're not distinguishing. They're kind of conflating it again.
Yeah. Like what I want them to do is make a distinction between the image and likeness of God and the dignity one gets when they are baptized. Like it seems like they're.
Oh, man. So it does say all people are called to manifest the ontological scope of their dignity on an existential and moral level as they, by their freedom, orient themselves toward the true good in response to God's love. Each person must also strive to live up to their full measure of their dignity. In light of this, one can understand how sin can wound and obscure human dignity, as it is an act contrary to that dignity. Yet sin can never cancel the fact that the human being is created in the image and likeness of God.
Yeah, I mean, that's perfectly fine.
So it does say then, and this is from Benedict, without the corrective supplied by religion, reason too can fall prey to distortions, as when it is manipulated by ideology or applied in a partial way that fails to take account of the dignity of the human person. Such misuse of reason, after all, was what gave rise to the slave trade and to many other social evils, not least the totalitarian ideologies of the 20th century.
And feminism.
Yeah, please just say
yeah, I have to throw feminism in there, right?
Yeah. The beginning of the next paragraph, it says, Pope Francis has recalled, in modern culture, the closest reference to the principle of the inalienable dignity of the person is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So I can't believe
Rob's sense went crazy when he saw it. He's like, they're referencing the UN Declaration on Human Rights.
It's one thing to reference it. It's another to say it's the closest reference to the principle of dignity. I mean, come on. There's no
way.
The ultra naturalistic gargantuan machine that it is. That's rough. Yeah.
Honestly, the rest of that is pretty good. Matter of fact, you've highlighted the end of paragraph 30 says the illusion that moral relativism provides the key for peaceful coexistence is actually the origin of divisions and the denial of the dignity of human beings. I thought that was a pretty good quote.
Father Nick said this morning, he's like, I don't like that people are going to sit here and point out the good stuff. If you have three heresies in the document, why are you pointing out the good stuff? But I think the takeaway from this, though, like to me, because people don't actually read these documents, the takeaway is the headlines you're getting. And the headlines are actually pretty good that you got. Like my biggest issue with FS, aside from the blessings themselves, was the headlines that came out, and it scandalized the world, and it gave people that weren't going to read the document the impression that the church was changing its teaching on marriage and things like that. And it caused a scandal itself, where I don't think this document does that.
No.
This document does not cause scandal.
No, I don't think it does either.
You have to be pretty well read.
Although, no.
To understand where a lot
of this document is. You have to be well read. You do, because it's like if you don't know like the difference between like ontological and existential dignities, et cetera, you're just going to be like, I don't know, big words. I'm going to go move on, et cetera. The one thing I will point out to your point, though, Anthony, is it's notice how, though, and this is, I think, where we just need to say, okay, before commenting on it, maybe it is just a good idea for everyone just to sit down and just read it and take the same standard and judgment parameter, because notice how the crowd that for the last like 3 or 4 months since Fiducia came out, that's been attacking us three and saying, you're just believing in the liberal narrative media, is the same people today posting media headlines that says, Vatican comes down on sex changes, etc. And so the thing is part of the reason of my joke today, which it was a joke, guys, you can calm down, especially the Groyper crowd, you can calm down. Part of it was just illustrating the fact that all Catholics, right, have, if you will, their own knee-jerk reactions that have come out over the last 5, 6 years, etc. This was born out of being 5 years of Catholic. But my point, particularly with the headlines, is, whether it's something we like or don't like, let's go and read it first and not just immediately assume because our favorite commentator or person says it's good or bad that it is that. But you have to be well read.
I kind of want to go through the good stuff. Like, I really want to pick apart the good stuff. So the gender stuff is paragraph 55, but I wrote feminism for paragraph 45. Why don't we jump to that real quick?
But before we do that,
the migrant stuff, we know, look, deportation, like the migrant stuff, we know they were going to give us that. I mean, it's just craziness, but before we get to that,
the end of paragraph 31 is a clear heresy. One must, moreover, reaffirm the fundamental right to religious freedom.
I mean, but that's all just an extension of the council.
Right. Yeah. Like, right? I said, that doesn't depart from.
It doesn't depart from the council. I'm looking for things that Francis is departing from post conciliar stuff, mm-hmm. I mean, the council itself is a departure, but I'm looking for where Francis goes a little haywire.
So you want 45?
Let's go 45, because I don't know why I wrote feminism. That was my note.
I have some notes here. So JP2 recognized that much remains to be done to prevent discrimination against those who have chosen to be wives and mothers. Now, I said that this is true, and it's increasing in our world. Like, it's harder to be a wife and a mother. But then it contradicts it with this. There is an urgent need to achieve real equity in every area. Fairness and career advancements. And it's like, how? Those are the things that make it hard to be a wife and mother. Like, come on.
Equity, man, dude. That's that Marxist buzzword. Equity.
I'll tell you, man. Like, the biggest, I think some of the scariest stuff that comes after the council is the stuff with feminism that they flirt with, because like there really is no scenario where a woman like a woman can work out of the home if it's a necessity to help her family get by, but there's no scenario where a woman having a career is a good thing. It's like it should never be viewed as a good thing. It should be viewed as a necessity at times. Like there are times where a mother and a wife has to help the family to get by, but it should never be seen as a good thing for women to be in the workplace. The damage is catastrophic. It rips families apart. There's the amount of infidelity that occurs because men and women are working in the same workplace. It's just the amount of stuff that they've softened their stance on. It's the scariest part is like when that council happened, it was during the sexual revolution, and there was never a time where the church's voice was needed more to clarify the revolution going on in the culture. And instead the council embraced that stuff and just kind of like went along with it because they didn't want to come off as mean.
Another right after that, when they're talking about urgent need to achieve real equity, one of the areas they say is the recognition of everything that is a part of the rights and duties of citizens in a democratic state.
Yeah, man. Look, you're not going to get integralism from the Vatican, no. So I don't know what to tell you.
But later in that paragraph, it actually gets pretty good. So it says, nor can we fail to condemn the widespread hedonistic and commercial culture, which encourages the systematic exploitation of sexuality and corrupts even very young girls into letting their bodies be used for profit. That's where the good part ends.
Yeah.
So good. Wait, I do want to, all right. So traditionally women would have worked in around the home and community building up the home front. They wouldn't have worked, for some faceless company unless it was desperate, but really that's a problem that arises from the Industrial Revolution. Like none of us are supposed, like I'm not even supposed right. to be at work 12 hours a day and then come home and see my kids for a few hours.
Were you even supposed to work in our homestead or have a family business that isn't really separate from the home itself?
Yeah, you guys are not going to like our take on this, but capitalism sucks, dude.
And that was some of the better parts of this document, actually.
Capitalism as it exists now isn't good. Like, I don't know, man. It rips families apart. I get the idea of like being able to get ahead and stuff, but I don't know, man. This whole system is just rigged against all families. I know Nick probably didn't like that, but.
Well, no, I don't disagree. Like, I mean, yeah, I would have maybe massaged it a little bit, but yeah, I don't disagree.
I'm not arguing for socialism or anything. I'm just saying the idea of men being out of the home all day and then coming home and seeing their kids at night. It's not ideal. Certainly not.
Yeah, no, it's not ideal. I am glad though that one thing I was happy about is that Rob, you read it, but that last sentence where it's talking about the exploitation of young girls, I didn't see it in the document, but I would have added like a particular section on like the OnlyFans phenomenon. You don't even, I mean, you could use the word that's what like an OG Pope would have done. Like if Innocent III was around today, he would have done an encyclical against OnlyFans already, most likely.
Anathemized that whole website.
Yeah, anathemized. He probably would have. But something to where it like really comes down harsh against that, right? But then also at the same time, equally talks about the inherent value that women have, I think would have been good, particularly in the internet realm, I think would have been helpful. But I'm glad at least they did talk about it.
So everyone's talking about the Michael Knowles interview, right?
I've tried to
stay out of that conversation because I know Miss B watches our show and I don't want to come off too harsh or anything. But the thing is, nobody's saying this woman isn't saved. That's not the conversation. It's like the conversation is it prudent for her to be the face of Christianity? Like this is a woman who has, it's not that God can't save someone who had that past. God can save anybody. Christ suffered for all of us and all of us have horrible sins in our past. It's somebody who lives such a public life like that. Part of the problem is the attention seeking, which, I mean, who am I to talk? I'm on here on screen seeking attention. But part of the attention seeking is where the issue comes in, because this is a person who was doing this behavior out of attention seeking behavior, and just switching the message a little bit. I can understand why people are up in arms about it. I'm not saying I agree on either side. I just think there is, you know, when we watched even The Mission, like when Robert De Niro's character kills his brother, he does mm-hmm. this penance that is like so severe. And I think we've lost that whole concept in the modern era, where it's like there should be a period of penance and, you know, taking a step back from the limelight and things like that. And I'm not trying to judge anybody. God works in everybody the way he works, but there is a lack of prudence to just putting that person up as the poster child for Christianity. Even with Shia LaBeouf, right? Shia LaBeouf has this conversion and we put him up as the poster child. And it's like, you got to be careful with stuff like that, man, because especially your first couple of years of having the faith, it's a roller coaster ride, man. Like, you're flying high. God's giving you all these graces, and you're getting a lot of consolations, and you're high as anything because you're just so in love with God and you want to share it. And then the crash comes because reality hits and it's not as easy as you thought it was. So it's smart to maybe take a step back if you're in that position, I think.
So yeah,
that's very wise.
Right in the area, right before 45. Was probably, in my opinion, the most tone-deaf statement the Vatican could make. And it reads, it's about sexual abuse. From this stems the church's ceaseless efforts to put an end to all kinds of abuse, starting from within. And then the beginning of the next paragraph says, violence against women is a global scandal that is gaining increasing recognition, and yet nothing is done about Ropnik. It is just unbelievably
tone. Yeah, it just seems like so much of like it's just rings hollow, you know.
Mm-hmm. Like all of this is that, you know, most of this keeps with Catholic doctrine, but it's put out there like a PR statement, if you will, to the world. You know, that's why I said like it sounds like as if like a social worker who is a Catholic writes a good amount of this. But one thing it's sad is that they mention, rightly, the abuse that's against women, but if they're wanting to talk about the sexual abuse first within the church, talk about it to also all of the young men who were equally molested, because more so it was young boys who were being molested. That was because of the huge homosexuality in the priesthood and the diaconate. And so that's kind of telling. It's like you should mention that, especially you, Your Excellency Cardinal Fernandez, who has so many scandals, if you will, running out of that office. It might be a good idea.
Yeah. I say we jump into the paragraph 55 through 60 and let's go through this and let's see what everybody's saying is they did it. You know, all the headlines are coming out. Vatican condemns gender reassignment surgery, all this stuff. Let's go through that and let's see what that sounds like.
So, do you want to literally read with each?
Yeah, let's read paragraph 55. We'll stop and then, you know, we'll make commentary.
So, this is gender theory. The church wishes, first of all, to reaffirm that every person, regardless of sexual orientation, ought to be respected in his or her dignity and treated with consideration, while every sign of unjust discrimination is to be carefully avoided, particularly any form of aggression and violence. For this reason, it should be denounced as contrary to human dignity the fact that, in some places, not a few people are imprisoned, tortured, and even deprived of the good of life solely because of their sexual orientation.
That's probably like Middle East, right?
Or Africa.
While a lot of that I agree with, because they do carefully use the phrase unjust persecution. Yeah. I don't like the phrase imprisonment next to torture, because yes, I don't think torture, etc. is good. But it's like, to be fair, imprisonment, I'm controversial in that respect, in the sense of like, yeah, like if this is something where it's notorious, especially if it's pushed upon people and there's pedophilia involved and stuff like that, I'm like, look, stuff needs to happen.
Yeah. Plus, I don't know of any country that imprisons people based upon just the orientation. It's based upon the act. So yeah, that and whole
pretty much means every single culture across the world before the sexual revolution had laws, you know, sodomy laws on the books. I mean, this was just, exactly. You know, if you got caught playing around with buggery, you know, you were going to get arrested. So it's a very strange change in stance, mm-hmm. you know, but yeah,
Anthony the orientation has the best vocabulary. That's vocabulary. Just like throw out these random words at buggery, you know.
That's what it was called, especially in England. In England, they call it buggery.
Yeah, it's true.
All right, so that was their caveat before they get into it.
56. At the same time, the church highlights the definite critical issues present in gender theory. On this point, Pope Francis has reminded us that the path to peace calls for respect for human rights in accordance with the simple yet clear formulation contained in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, whose 75th anniversary we recently celebrated. These principles are self-evident and commonly accepted. Regrettably, in recent decades, attempts have been made to introduce new rights that are neither fully consistent with those originally defined nor always acceptable. They have led to instances of ideological colonization, which gender theory plays a central role. The latter is extremely dangerous since it cancels differences in its claim to make everyone equal. And I don't know about you, but ideological colonization sounds like America spreading democracy.
Yeah, it does. But I'd also argue that I don't think the human rights are self-evident. Like, they're not self-evident. They're mm-hmm. self-evident to a Christian culture, a culture who's been saturated in Christianity for the past 2,000 years, maybe. But they're not self-evident, because if you go back before Christianity, none of that stuff was self-evident. It's self-evident to a culture enlightened by the love of Christ over, you know, the West.
Maybe you could say they're self-evident, like, in and of themselves, but they're not like they're not, if you will, very visibly self-evident. So it's kind of right. like the distinction that St. Thomas makes, where he says, like, we can know objectively from reason that God exists. However, that truth, you know, it doesn't present itself immediately to ourselves. You know, we may see, he uses the example of saying, like, you may see a guy walking far away and you can tell it's a man walking to you, but there's a difference between saying, like, a man walking toward you versus Peter's walking toward you. Yeah. And maybe that's one way you could take it, where it's like, okay, some of these rights are technically self-evident, like in and of themselves, but because of sin, because of darkness, I agree with you. You know,
and this is a good point. The law, like, God, you know, the natural law is written on our hearts. So
okay. It's not self-evident how to necessarily live them out in daily life, but
yeah,
natural rights are self-evident.
And I'd want to see like an actual list of like what the UN considers natural rights before I would actually say, all of these are for sure, you know, the natural law.
But this is why I said it's like it's very wishy-washy. Like, this whole lead up is just all these caveats and references to the UN and all this stuff. I just think it's very wishy-washy, you know. So, all right, let's get to it.
57. Regarding gender theory, whose scientific coherence is the subject of considerable debate among experts. The church recalls that human life in all its dimensions, both physical and spiritual, is a gift from God. This gift is to be accepted with gratitude and placed at the service of the good. Desiring a personal self-determination, as gender theory prescribes, apart from this fundamental truth that human life is a gift, amounts to a concession to the age-old temptation to make oneself God, entering into competition with the true God of love revealed to us in the gospel. So it's defining gender theory as Satanism.
I like that. That's actually pretty good.
That's a good
like
line.
It is. It's telling God, I don't care how you made me. I can determine myself. That's pretty good. I mean, it was a long-winded caveat before we got there, but I think that's pretty good.
Now the next paragraph.
I think that
you go, Nick.
Oh, I was just gonna say, I think that. Yeah, I fully agree. That's, I think, a great paragraph. I just wonder, though, how philosophically consistent it is, though, with the same crowd that says freedom of religion. Because to me, it's like, if you say that you should have freedom of religion, and therefore you pick your religion, if you will, I don't see why that wouldn't logically extend over to gender and sex, if you will.
That's a good point.
And also a pope from before the council would just come out and say, this is demonic and we need to do something about it. Like, it's just so
like when popes and councils in the past were wordy, it was to tell you just how damned you were.
Yeah,
man. It wasn't to soften it. It was to
like, could you imagine like a forceful statement on this topic coming out? Like, it's just not a forceful statement.
The next paragraph, when I read it, I thought to myself, this has to be Anthony's favorite paragraph. So paragraph 58, another prominent aspect of gender theory is that it intends to deny the greatest possible difference that exists between living beings, sexual difference.
Yeah.
This foundational difference is not only the greatest imaginable difference, but is also the most beautiful and most powerful of them. In the male-female couple, this difference achieves the most marvelous of reciprocities. It thus becomes the source of that miracle that never ceases to surprise us, the arrival of new human beings in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably the best paragraph in the whole thing.
Yeah, it's nice. I like that.
59. In this sense, respect for both one's own body and that of others is crucial in light of the proliferation of claims to new rights advanced by gender theory. This ideology envisages a society without sexual differences, thereby eliminating the anthropological basis of the family. It thus becomes unacceptable that some ideologies of this sort, which seek to respond to what are at times understandable aspirations, manage to assert themselves as absolute and unquestionable, even dictating how children should be raised. It needs to be emphasized that biological sex and the sociocultural role of sex, in parentheses gender, can be distinguished but not separated. Therefore, all attempts to obscure reference to the sexual difference between men and women are to be rejected. We cannot separate the masculine and the feminine from God's work of creation, which is prior to all our decisions and experiences, and where biological elements exist which are impossible to ignore. Only by acknowledging and accepting this difference and reciprocity can each person fully discover themselves, their dignity, and their identity.
Yeah, and I thought that that was a pretty good line too. And that's what I was kind of hinting at, is that they do make that distinction between like what the leftist crowd does of gender and sex, and says like, hey, yeah, you can't go around playing God and dividing up willy-nilly what you think male and female is.
Yeah. I mean, overall, like I said, I don't think this is some super controversial document. I don't think you're not going to have the blowback you had from Fiducia. It's just not that, no. You know. There's some problematic stuff in it, but
I give it like a C plus, something like that.
You judging on a curve? You're grading on a curve?
Yeah, like, I give it a C plus.
In some sense, it definitely fails, right? I mean,
it's an F by traditional standards. It's a B plus by Francis standards.
and like Nick, C plus post council in general.
No, because you got to add in stuff like Veritatis Splendor in there. No, post council, it's like a C minus. But for Francis, it's like a B minus. Like, I mean, you really have to think about the nonsense that has come out in the past decade.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fair. I agree. Yeah, because, pre-council, you're right. They would have just failed you for one
failed
major.
Right off the bat.
Like, you're total done. Failure. You're done.
You're never getting this document written pre-council.
Yeah, that's why it took Benedict so long to get his doctoral thesis done, and why Garrigou kicked out John Paul II. He was just like, get out of here. You're right. But it's fair. You got to give it a curve, I guess, in the
post. Do we got to grade on a curve?
Do we want to talk about the part that is aimed right at podcasters, it feels like?
Yeah. Let's go over that. Let's see if we're in trouble.
So digital violence. Paragraph 61. Although the advancement of digital technologies may offer many possibilities for promoting human dignity, it also increasingly tends towards the creation of a world in which exploitation, exclusion, and violence grow, extending even to the point of harming the dignity of the human person. Consider, for example, how easy it is through these means to endanger a person's good name with fake news and slander.
Yeah, that's why I would say
there is something to
There is definitely something to that. I get that.
There's something to that, but not just that. Like some of the pylons you see online, like you really do. Like you've seen people get driven to end their own lives because they just got false accusations against people. I mean, I read something the other day where a guy was accused of impropriety with a woman, and one of the his whole end of life letter was him saying, "I am innocent of this, and you people have completely." He goes, "I'm no longer in this world. I have no reason to lie. I am innocent of this, but you people have destroyed my lives, and I'm done." And it's you can absolutely you do have to be cautious of what.
It says, digital communication wants to bring everything out into the open. People's lives are combed over, laid bare, and bandied about, often anonymously. Respect for others disintegrates, and even as we dismiss, ignore, or keep others' distance, we can shamelessly peer into every detail of their lives. Such tendencies represent a dark side of digital progress.
Yeah, man. People getting doxxed.
I agree with all that. And yeah, Sean, I think you're right. Yeah, send that paragraph to Michael Lofton and quit exposing people, because that calls him out. But I think the term fake news, that's the one term I probably wouldn't have used, just because it's a charged term that I think has bad.
You could say detraction, calumny, slander,
Even like yellow journalism. Like yellow journalism, I think would have been maybe fine. Because fake news, it's just like
it's such a Trumpist connotation. Like it has so much to do with American media.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Fake news. It's such an American media phrase.
It'd be hilarious if it is something like yellow journalism in the Latin, but then the guy just translated fake news.
Fake news.
This document isn't even written in Latin.
Never mind. I'm giving it an F. I'm giving it an F.
Yeah. Days of getting documents in Latin are on the way out.
So a couple other good parts of that paragraph real quick. Digital media can expose people to the risk of addiction, isolation, and gradual loss of contact with concrete reality, blocking the development of authentic interpersonal relationships. I mean,
that's about the Groypers, right? I love you guys.
My Catholic community is this online because it's so hard to find one in real life. Now I it's not a replacement for, but I think it's better than nothing.
We're at least having a conversation, and we try to even when the people are watching,
the Vatican told us to touch grass.
they did essentially, but I think it's why we try to make the audience so interactive on our show. So at least they're part of the conversation, a lot of times you guys will say something, we'll highlight the comment. It adds to the conversation and stuff. Like there is something to having some kind of a community from all this stuff, it's I don't know, but I think the idea of, isolating yourself and getting addicted to the thing and the likes and all that stuff, the dopamine hits, that's all stuff we all really do have to watch out for.
Yeah, exactly. I just wish you would tie some of these things into the spiritual problems that arise from it. Because notice how a lot of these things are correct, right? He's talking about manipulations, depressions, etc. But then talk about the context of fake news, the Eighth Commandment. Talk about in this context, the importance of not bullying because it falls into slander against your neighbor and against true, elements like that would have been good to see. The fact that hey, you're a spiritual master of souls and actually care for their own growth. Just the natural stuff.
The things you're saying are just way too Catholic.
I know. That's the problem.
So
way too Catholic.
The next part is the conclusion. In the beginning of this, complain all you want about Taylor Marshall's book, Infiltration, but this sentence, it's like they were begging for Infiltration to be written. On the 75th anniversary of the promulgation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, once again based on the French Revolution's Declaration of the Rights of Man, Pope Francis reaffirmed that this document is, and I quote, like a master plan from which many steps have been taken, but many more still need to be made.
Yeah, man.
And see, that's the thing where it's like, if you were to take that statement, which is the big concluding paragraph that's summarizing, if you will, the whole document, it really does encapsulate where it's like, we can agree with so much, but it has this spirit of naturalism that does kind of run through it.
So I think that actually kind of explains what this document is. I think this document is aimed at the UN and telling them, yo, you guys got to chill a little bit on some of these other, we'll get on board with you with everything, but you got to ease up with the gender
stuff.
Please
don't persecute us yet. Like we're following your plan.
Yeah. It's like, if you guys push too hard with this stuff, we can't really be seen publicly on board with you guys. You have to slow down a little bit is how it comes off.
No, 100% true. But that's why I'm like, hey, especially Catholic Zoomer brethren, it's like, read that last paragraph and look through everything else. Like, I don't see how we can say everything's just mega based whenever it's like he's citing the UN, which is based on the French Revolution. It's not
like, yeah, man, like you guys can't be saying based France. It's like, guys, your standard is so low. Mm-hmm. If you think this is a based document, it's just not. Go read anything. Like, if you guys ever read anything from before the council, like you read anything
or read anything.
Have you ever read anything at all? But when you do, you just see it's just such a deep contrast. I mean, we're all just waiting to see what happens next. I mean, that's all. We're all just trying to have some fun along the way, talk to each other, keep everybody in the church. There's some crazy stuff coming. We got like Jay Dyer coming on to argue soon. Me and Jay are going to discuss the differences in Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy. That should be an interesting one.
How many times have you said you did not want to do that with Jay?
I know, but he keeps pressing, and I'm not scared of Jay Dyer, dude.
I thought the conversation was going to be a little bit more like limited, directed. Like
it will be. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, let's try to steel man each other's position. I'm going to ask him, what do you think is the best argument for Catholicism? What do you think the worst is? And I'll tell him what I think the best argument for Eastern Orthodoxy is and the worst is, and then we'll get into some of the differences. But we've had him on twice, and both times we're just not even talking about the faith. Whatever. Yeah. We'll get on, we'll talk a little bit about it. I mean, he's not going to swing my position, and I'm not going to swing his position, right?
Just for the record, when you say, like, when you start talking about the best argument for Orthodoxy, if a image of Francis goes up on screen, it may or may not be my fault. I'm sorry.
I think the best argument for Orthodoxy is that they didn't have a lot of the modernist stuff infiltrated. I think that's the only decent argument for it, to be honest. But I can just go to the SSPX or something. That's really.
By the way, Nick, I went the first time this weekend.
Hey, let's go. Rob is officially a Chad. More so than he normally is. So, well, how was your experience? Were you like incinerated because of your partial communion status?
So Saturday night we went to a Novus Ordo, anticipatory mass, because I wanted to go with my grandma. We were down in the cities. I don't often get to see my grandma a lot. She's 93, mm-hmm. almost 94. So I wanted to spend as much time as I can with her, and I figured I'd go to mass with her. The next morning, we then went to the SSBX, and it was, I actually think I'm going to write an article about just the crazy differences. So,
oh, wow. That'd be awesome.
You were saying you thought the Novus Ordo was invalid, right?
I thought, you know how generally when a priest prays the words of consecration, they're physically like praying over the sacred species, like, especially in the traditional mass, like, you know, like mm-hmm. their breath is on the sacred species. This priest, as he would pray the words of institution, held the sacred species up. So I checked with a couple of priests to see if that was improper form, but it doesn't seem so.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, that sounds valid. It's just classic, horrible treatment of the substance.
But they handed out blessed prayer shawls after mass, so that's a plus, right, guys?
Did they really?
For real.
Like Jewish prayer shawls, or like what kind of prayer shawls?
As they say during mass, I probably not so quietly say to my wife, since when are we Amish?
That's crazy. Dude, please write an article. That'd be so cool.
I'm actually, I've started it, so.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah. So, all right, man, we're going to wrap this one up. I think, What do we got? Do we got anything for Thursday, Rob? I don't think so. Nick, if you want to join us. I don't know if you're free. Yeah. You've been taking a lot of your time up lately, though.
I'm pretty free in the evening. So, yeah, if you guys don't get anybody else, I'll come on for sure.
All right. So we'll do a news-packed show on Thursday. We'll see what's in the news, and we'll go about it.
Yeah, because isn't the it's not tonight, is it? But is the debate between Candace and Ben? It's like sometime this week or something.
Are they actually doing it?
Yeah, no. So did you guys check this out? It'd be newsworthy yourselves just to look at it, but they got – like an actual debate scheduled on Daily Wire, and it's going to be live on YouTube and Daily Wire Plus and all the platforms, etc. And they're going to talk two subjects. One, just broadly speaking, the Israel-Palestinian conflict. And two, this is the more interesting one for me. What is the meaning of anti-Semitism?
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
So that should be epic.
Oh, man, that's great. Yeah, Nick is the unofficial third host. We're trying to figure out how to make him. I mean, he's part of the team. You know, he's always, whenever we don't have a guest, we just like, Nick, you free? So, we're hoping to go on his channel a little bit, but he hasn't invited us on. So,
hey, you guys are definitely going to be the first one whenever I get around to doing live. I'm just still stuck in the era of, you know, journaling, pre-record stuff. I'm still a noob.
What's funny is that's the area we're trying to get into a little bit more. And then you're trying to get into our area a little more.
Oh, really?
Maybe Nick can help us with some of this stuff, man.
See, Nick. Oh, that'd be easy. Nick is smart. He doesn't have a Twitter handle.
Oh, he has one. He just doesn't. It's an anonymous handle.
I do not. I like. I get screenshots from people.
Oh, that's like, what it is. You get screenshots because you know a lot. You know all the gossip on Twitter all the time.
I see people send me that stuff all the time. I mean, you guys can hit me up if you're in the Telegram chat with stuff. But I get depressed. I'm like, I'm not going on here.
it's a lot. I mean, it consumes me a lot, man. It's bad.
You know, if we don't have anything planned for Thursday, Anthony.
All right, shoot. That's too soon.
Too soon. That's we too used to pump out two a week, man.
I think what you guys do is the next trivia you do it right after the news, like breaking news that the Holy Father passes, right? You do your episode on the Holy Father and then you play a game of trivia.
That's not a bad idea.
But then you make the trip. Yeah, exactly. The trivia theme is Pope Francis.
All right. So we'll be back on Thursday. Nick will join us. And we will see. Somebody said a Flanders. Oh, yeah. When are you and Tim debating? Are you debating?
Oh, yes. Yeah, you know, we're going to debate. I think the day is the 19th, if memory serves. But basically, we're going to be talking about like SSPX versus like FSSP, and it's a good-hearted debate. There's no beef between us, if any of y'all are wondering. And we're also going to be, this is actually going to be pretty epic, on the Meaning of Catholic starting the 14th of this month. We're going to be doing a live show, I think every week, going over all of Archbishop Lefebvre's books. So get a little bit more of an actual based and hope for Meaning of Catholic again.
All right. I'm sure there's going to be some drama behind the scenes with that series.
Oh, heck yeah, there is.
All right, guys. We're going to wrap it. We will see you guys.
Have a good night, everyone.
Adios. Take care, y'all.